All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Don't forget, Amir, you recording?
Yeah. Okay.
What? Somebody else use his real name? Ain't that a bitch?
I mean, shit, that's what his mama called
him. Oh, yeah, that's it.
Mama named Clay. I'm calling Clay.
Yes, I am Amir. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, what can I say? Our guests today are the pride of my hometown of Philadelphia. They are, in my opinion, and I'm very biased, they are simply one of the finest, most talented singing groups in history. They have made classic records. They have broken records. And when those records got broken, they broke records with their own records. Three singles single-handedly have occupied the number one spot for 43 weeks in a row. That is no small feat when it's just spread out through three singles. Only two other artists in recording history have achieved that feat. And no, his name isn't Michael Jackson. Elvis and the Beatles. Yo, to be alive, to watch Beatles fans cry over Into the Road record-breaking Beatles, that was one of the most craziest days I've ever seen. We can call them the last true R&B group. We can call them the forefathers. We know that any group of individuals that call themselves boys band, they know they owe this group everything from NSYNC to BTS. They owe them greatly. Please welcome to Questlove Supreme, finally, the one and only Boyz II Men.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. There you go.
It's finally because we only got one call.
Right.
Damn. Wait. Is this going to be?
Check. You know, hey, you know what type of conversation is going to be. We're high school, like
that's
you
know. Bad. Yeah, it's going to be real.
Wait a minute. Fonte had a look at Fonte's face right now. Fonte's all right. The Jill Scott episode went somewhere. The music episode went somewhere.
Boy, listen.
This is about to go somewhere. You want to talk to Reach? Oh, yeah.
This is as real as you're going to get. Like, we, you know, we only know one way to talk to each other.
I'm ready for this, boy.
Let's go. Yeah.
Actually, wait. My first question. People are dying to know. What the hell did y'all do to Sudden Impact?
I don't know what we did.
That wasn't our group.
I'll tell you what, I'm playing. Want to know what we did? We tried to save them after Mike Bibbins got rid of them. We tried to sign them to Stone Creek in Philly and took them over to Tommy Mottola, and he said, "Oh hell no!" Then somebody named the Backstreet Boys came out, and then they disappeared.
Wow.
Absolutely. If you really want to know what happened.
Motherfucking Nathan Morris, everyone.
Thank you.
I can tell this is going to be a classic interview already.
Yes,
no. Where are you guys right now? I assume that, and yeah. I know you guys get tired of asking, like, when people see you individually, like, where the other group at, as if you're attached to the hip.
Yeah, like we're conjoined together. Like, no,
right, because I can never be nowhere without, right. Where's Tariq at, you know?
Right, exactly.
Well, so where are you guys right now?
I'm in LA, Juan's in Vegas, and Nate's in a big old house in Tampa, Florida, sitting by the river.
A big old house like everybody else. Everybody else should be in a big old house too.
Sitting by a lake, watching.
I'm in a pretty nice size house.
All right, I see that. When okay, based on the reality that we're living right now, when's the last time that you three were physically in the room at the same time?
February.
I will tell you this. Yeah, March. But I'll tell you one even crazier. When we left each other in March, by the time we got to May or June, it was probably the longest that we've ever been apart from each other since high school.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to say. Has this been the biggest break that you guys have had?
Yeah, without a doubt. Without seeing each other or talk, yeah, physically, yeah. We went on breaks, but we saw each other. We hung out. Juan and Sean used to live around the corner, stuff like that. But like physically being apart for this long, it's the longest.
I missed the hell out of those niggas.
So yeah, how does that affect, especially when you've been singing together for so long, for so consistent, how does that affect you? Like when I hang up, we're about to do like our first Roots show in 8 months. And I'm actually nervous about it. Cause like we're going to have rehearsal, which is, I mean, we did it so much that the automatic pilot was good, but like, how does it, when you're not in that rhythm anymore, like how does that affect?
I mean,
we don't know. We ain't never did it.
it's never happened before. You know what I'm saying? But like you said, you know, groups that have been together for this long and, you know, working together, we pretty much know our roles. We know what roles we play. So, you know, I'm pretty sure it's autopilot as well. It's just, you know, getting in the room together and, you know, remembering our notes and the steps and all kinds of stuff like that. That's the only thing. But for the most part, man, this is weird. You know what I'm saying? It's definitely weird, but you know, we got to make the most of it.
Is this a welcome break? Most artists that I talk to say like, this is the first real sleep I've gotten. This is the first, like, I mean, monetary issues aside of worrying about, you know, how your life is going to be affected. Like, is this a welcome break or is it just like,
I mean, I think it's more individual, that question to be answered. I mean, for me, I think 2 months, that's a welcome break for me. You know what I'm saying? But after 2 months, I'm ready to you know, be where we are. You know, I'm ready to get back on stage. I'm ready to see my brothers. I'm ready, you know what I'm saying? You got to have that energy flow of people that are like-minded around you and create the same way and think the same way musically around you. So after 2 months, I'm like, yo, I gotta do it. But you know, it's welcome for about 2 months for me. I don't know about everybody else.
Now you're just antsy to get back to whatever.
I mean, normal. Yeah, I mean, it's the same. So I think we were all due. There comes a ceiling that, you know, you tour after a while, you know, you want to say, okay, you know what? Let's fall back for a second and kind of like, you know, look at our houses for a little while and go food shopping and do regular normal stuff. Because I think with us, that's the balance that's required for all of us. We've never really been about, and you know us, Amir, we've never been about all the you know, the spectacle and all that other stuff. That just came with the job. But for the most part, you would see us driving down South Street, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, in our cars, getting some music or, you know, getting some food or just hanging out or whatever. That's just what we like to do.
Right.
You know, and the stage is just another persona that when, you know, when we're on stage, we go off and we do what we need to do and we sing and we jump around and we act like fools. And then after that, you know, we back to just being normal Sean, Wanya, and Nate. You know what I mean? So, you know, that's always been the ebb and flow. And as it should be with most artists, like, you know, we require both in order for us to feel whole. You know what I'm saying? Okay. So I miss it. I think the guys miss it. We miss being out there and performing because, like I said, it feels like it's half of us that's kind of missing to some degree. You know, yeah. We like to be home. We like to chill and all that stuff. But, you know, we ain't gonna lie. We like to entertain. This is what we do.
One thing I was curious to know, I saw y'all came to Raleigh, man, this is probably like 10 plus years ago. This is a minute ago. And y'all performed and, you know, it was outside and y'all was in the suits and the choreography. I think y'all were doing like the Motown. It was one of the cover records y'all done. And show was amazing. And we all like we loved it. I was curious to know, how do y'all preserve y'all voices after all these years, man? Because y'all still sounded exactly like the records 20 plus years later.
I think part of it is exactly what we were saying earlier. It's like we haven't really been away from each other this long. I mean, I plead the fifth on the other topic, but the fact that we've always, we sang all the time. There hasn't been months that have gone by where we haven't sang or we haven't performed. So, you know, it's like a muscle. If you work it out all the time, it'll be there for you. And because we've never really ever been separated in our whole lives, we sing almost every other week or so. And I mean, definitely in the last 5 years or so, we've been extremely consistent. I mean, with Vegas, there's probably not a week that's gone by in the last 5 years that we haven't sang.
What's up?
So it's a consistency.
What are y'all doing now to make sure that it's?
Oh, we sing.
Well, I mean, we still sing. We just don't sing together. I mean, okay. I'm sure, you know, we know each other's personalities. So, you know, we sing around the house. We sing on stuff we create. I mean, we just sing. And I think we're just, it's funny, when we first got started, our role manager years ago, Khalil, you know, we would sing so much that every time we would sing, he would pull out a cup almost as if, you know, you guys trying to sing for some coins or whatever. Because, you know, we hadn't quite been successful then. So he was like, you know, you got to learn when to tone it down and when, you know, you just can't sing all the time. But I think that's one thing that he never really could take out of us. So over time, you know, this is just something that we've always done.
Okay.
So real quick.
Yeah.
What you mean by you plead the fifth on the last question, then? I need to...
Oh, no. Well, see, again, the difference for me is that, unlike you guys, I fly, before we did this, for the last 5 years, I fly almost 5,000 miles a week for Vegas. So when you talk about needing time away, I probably need a lot more than you guys do, because it's just too much for me to do. I mean, I'm flying east, west every single week.
So for that residency, you were doing... Coming to Vegas just for shows and then going.
I live in Florida. I've been flying back and forth for the last 5 years, every week.
And are you still, Nate, were you still doing your show as well? Were you still doing your show?
Yes, Nate. Stop being
ridiculous. See, the thing is.
I'm answering Juan's question because I know what he's saying. It's like.
I just need a clarification because, you know what I'm saying? I laid out.
I need clarification.
But that's what I was saying. It's like, you know, it's not the group per se. It's just when you.
I get it.
My grind is a little bit different than you guys because you guys are on the West Coast. You're right there. You're 30 minutes away. You know what I'm saying? But when you got to wake up at 4:30 every Thursday or Friday, fly out every weekend, turn right back around, and that's not counting what we do during the week. Right. I mean, nigga need a break.
Right.
I get it. So that means Nate is James Poyser and Wanye is Amir. See, I was like, I'm going to be in Manhattan. I'll move to Manhattan. James is like, no, I'm going to go further down south to Delaware and drive every day for 3 hours. All right, I get it now.
Yeah, that's probably about it, but you're about right.
This leads to my next question. So, you know, I was immersed in my particular culture at Creative and Performing Arts High School. For those that don't know, we all went to the same high school.
Never made it. Never ever made it to advisory. Like maybe advisory. Twice. Because he sat right next to me. I know he wasn't there.
We know who he was.
The thing is that, you know, I don't know much about the singing culture at Creative and Performing Arts. So my particular experience there was, all right, first of all, like I had a kind of a Bloods and Crips environment. The Bloods were like the jazz heads. So in order to get Chris and Joey's respect, I had to study all this 40s jazz to let them know I speak their language.
Right, right.
And then on the other side, Kurt Rosenwinkel. I don't know if you remember Kurt Rosenwinkel, but
I do.
He's like, he's a massive deal right now in the world of jazz. Wow. So he would try to force me to unlearn all the old shit that Chris and Joey wanted me to learn.
Right.
And then I'm going behind both of their backs and doing hip hop with Tariq. Kind of like whatever gang was winning, that's the side I was on.
Right.
But what was the culture for vocal majors on the fourth floor.
Oh, I can.
And like, take me through it.
I can break that down because honestly, I wasn't in any of it. Because when I came,
but y'all would break out in song.
Yeah, like, but see, here's the thing. When I came in, Wanye wasn't in yet. I came in '86, and Wanye came in '87.
You were there as a freshman, okay?
When I came in, you had your cliques. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like everybody. You had your gospel kids. You know, the ones that just straight up sang gospel all day, every day.
Jesus is Lord.
All day. You know what I'm saying? And then you had the cool kids. You know what I'm saying? That Nate used to hang around. Like
Let me tell you, if you want to do it, be right. I did not hang around them. They hung around me. Let's get it right. I need to clear it up.
They hung around Nate because most of them was from North Philly. And as you know, Kappa was in South Philly. And you know, every day after school, Palumbo kids would come outside and try to beat our asses every day because we could sing and dance, right?
I didn't have that problem.
A lot of those dudes hung around Nate, as he says it, because, you know, that was the cool kids.
That's my neighborhood. So they want to get their ass beat, so they hung out.
Wait, how real was the Palumbo? Because, again, I was so, when you're in that basement, you could hide all day and nobody would miss you until you get to the... I was separated from all that shit because we just real. Stay in the basement.
It was real.
How real was that Palumbo shit? The bottom line is the fact is
one of my friends got his nose broken.
By them little kids?
Let me explain it to you. I got you.
Okay.
Those little kids, their big brothers were from the projects.
There you go.
So they lived in my neighborhood. I went to the school because I was local. Most of the other guys went to the school because they were from Northeast and it was a magnet school. So when they came down, you know, with their little, you know, so-called Gucci shoes and whatnot, my neighborhood guys wasn't happy about that. And then they would be in the school and they would mess with the little Colombian kids and they'd go tell their big brothers. And by the end of the day, their big brothers would be waiting outside. And I'm the only one that can walk outside and not have a problem. So they hung around me.
They was young, yo. They was like baby's kids. It was like fifth and sixth graders.
We had no money. Yeah. Because we had no money, our neighborhood schools had to be split.
Ninth graders.
High school that we shared.
It wasn't them. It was their bigger brothers that was our age.
I got you.
So it wasn't the actual Palumbo.
A lot of little kids.
But they was causing the issue, though.
Yeah.
Well, what it was the school was, it was a big high school, one of those older schools. And, you know, it's a neighborhood with no money. So they split our high school at the same building with lower grade kids that were like seventh and eighth grade. So they were on one side of the building. We were on the other side.
And they didn't
those upper crusty so-called Kappa choir people that like to, you know, mess with little broke kids would call them all kinds of names. They go home and tell their family and then they'd have to deal with it after school.
But you know what, Nate? It wasn't always them calling them names and stuff. It was the fact that the artists are eccentric. You know what I'm saying? So we walk different, we talk different, we act different. You know
we
what I'm saying?
We act like we had a future.
And I'm not going to front.
I mean, of course, there was some interaction. I'm sure the interaction escalated it to be what it became. But the thought process behind it is there was a lot of fucking kids in that school. And the fact that we all had to interact at some point in time, whether it was crossing the hallways, I'm sure there was a little bit of eyeing and things like that. But when you left the school, you're not thinking that what happened in school is going to
change. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you're not thinking that. So when you walk outside and you see all these dudes standing on the wall, like there he go right there, or there they go. It didn't even have to be that person. It's just they wanted to make sure that they made themselves known and seen that this is their neighborhood and y'all going to have to run if y'all come out here. That's what it was.
Or,
or just stop being a
superhero like that. Anyway, I digress. Back to the vocal culture.
There you go.
So you had the so-called.
This is my favorite episode. I just said the same shit.
You had the so-called cool kids, right? That all hung out with Nate, and then you had the geeks, right? The nerds, right?
Mm-hmm.
The spazoids,
Sean.
The horribles, the guys.
Time out, Sean. You weren't a dweeb. Nah.
I was.
You was pulling Johns though.
I was
he was pulling Johns when he got in the group.
Let me explain.
I don't think I got enough of that.
That was very true, which is one of the reasons why I had somewhat of an issue. Because listen, I was the same nigga when I went into school, right?
Right.
I could sing the same. I hung around the same people, even when I was in the group, the whole nine yards.
Not really, though.
Get in the group. You know that show, February 14th.
The one y'all cheat with the sparkles?
Yes.
They really with the cheat. You know what, nigga? If you had some sparkles, you'd put them bitches out there to stuff play.
I never let that shit down.
Man said y'all had the whole outfit since high school.
Listen.
Yo, me and Rico, you going to kill that shit, boy. They had sparkles in their hand for like...
Let me tell you something. If you and Boys to Men, you going all the way. That's the only way we know how to do it.
All right. So to bring our people up to date, there was a Valentine's Day performance in school. And, you know, this is the moment where you felt like, all right, now we're about to kill
you. Yeah, you thought your instrument was just going to do it. Nah,
yo, it's going to be on, nigga. It's going to be on. Because
you need some sparkles.
I lied to you, Nate.
He ran into the sparkles.
I lied to you, not.
Like, niggas got beat by sparkles.
He's very traumatized by this, y'all.
Go ahead.
But I'm dead serious. When y'all walked on stage, I was like, oh shit, they're like a real group. Like, this isn't Unique Attraction anymore. Mm-hmm. It's like a real group. And the thing was, girls were screaming in the audience like it was Ed Sullivan on the Beatles.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I was like, yo, but dude, like,
I just sat next to
them. Juan still might owe me 75 cents. Like, this is still them. They're not a real group. But for that 10-minute performance, y'all transformed into like, it was like the Jacksons came to school and shit. And I was like, wow. Like,
let me tell you, dude, honestly, we didn't really realize it until that. It was one of those things where I think the same way you felt it at that moment is the same way we felt it. And we literally had no idea what the hell was happening.
None.
Wow.
I mean,
that was a transformative moment.
It's crazy you bring that up because, I mean, like Sean said, it was girls that... You know, I'm pretty sure we all tried to, like, you know, send my holler at during the year. You know what I mean? And they basically gave us no attention whatsoever.
Word.
Bruh. Because you remember, the principal came and stopped it.
Yes. He was going to stop it because riots were about to break out.
Because it was so loud. The crowd was like, this is not a concert. This is not. You remember that?
Yeah, it's so funny that y'all remember this.
In our poses, looking stupid as shit,
we were rolling like.
Wait, that's really weird. I thought I was the only one that remembered this moment. I was like, I wasn't even going to bring it up because I'm like, oh, they don't remember that shit.
Let me tell you something. We used to talk about it on the tour bus all the time, dude. Like Juan said and Sean said, nobody wouldn't talk to us, dude. We all had our own little cliques, but when we were doing Boys to Men stuff. Because everybody in the group in the school could sing, you know, Amel could sing, like everybody could sing. It was just like, okay, well, everybody could sing, but it wasn't just in the school, it was after school when we stayed there till 10 o'clock at night, or when we went down the subway at 10 o'clock at night. It was all that stuff that put us a little bit ahead of everybody else. And it became normal for us that's just the way we're supposed to do it.
Yeah, we didn't stop at 3 o'clock, and it was just crazy because those girls, man, after that performance, the same girls, I remember them, Khadija.
She called.
It's personal.
She said, She sat right next to me right after the class, and she was like, "Why you didn't give me a rose?" And I was like, "That's why you didn't give me a number."
I'm not gonna make it.
Yo, man. Hey, I'm telling you, I love this.
You know how important it was to, like, you know, bag an upperclassman. And I was like in the tenth grade, and I had an upperclassman for a girlfriend, like a straight senior, like like weeks after the show, like I had a baddie.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so y'all went from virgins to not virgins.
But I'm gonna tell you what's crazy though. When you look at the whole musical landscape of the school at that time, it's like, you know, we used to try to do New Edition stuff like that and sound modern, and that was kind of our niche. But like, you guys and stuff was interesting to us because it was like, our parents would hear y'all do y'all jazz stuff and be like, "Ooh," we'd be like, "That's my friend. Like, he's not playing no old stuff." Like, and you knew the vibe because it was like, if older people fell in love with you guys and stuff, it was fire. Not that young people didn't, but we could mentally soak in all that deep jazz stuff y'all had going on. So we would just watch and watch older people just lose their mind. Like, these guys are so deep in their gear, you know, they're, you know, so rich. And we'd be like, we can't even read half the music, the stuff that they playing. It's like, it was interesting. It was, you guys were more cultured than we could ever get at that age in our life, musically.
And let me tell you, something, Amir. Like, even now, like, we would tell people in interviews that those 4 years were probably some of the best years, arguably, in that school, because so much talent came out of those 4 years. Mm-hmm. That it was something going on.
Can you talk about it real quick, Sean? Because it's common knowledge to y'all, but to the rest of the world, people don't know what came out of Kappa. Like, can you just talk about some of the talent?
It was us. It was Tariq and Amir. It was Amel LaRue. It was
Christian McBride, Joey DeFrancesco.
Like it was Rose so Winkle. Many established, now established, still touring the world, making money, you know, winning awards, the whole nine yards, that happened in that 4 years. And we all went to the same school together.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte Gallo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I came to Kappa.
You came in 11th. With me.
You came in 11th grade as well?
No, but the year you came in, I was already there.
Right. So the thing was is that the first incarnation of the group was Unique Attraction. How did that dissolve, and how did it morph into Boyz II Men?
The first incarnation was in 85.
Oh, okay.
That was me. That was none of the guys that you know other than me. So
not even
me,
Mark Nelson.
Not even Mark Nelson.
Okay.
No. Matter of fact, yeah, Mark. No, not even Mark Nelson. Mark was right after that. We had one guy kick out. So right on the end of that was guys you don't know other than Mark. And as people would graduate school and leave the group or quit the group or their girl pull them out, you know, all the crazy stuff, you know, right. I would just put, you know, other people back in the group. Now, it's funny because Juan was actually picked before anybody else, before he actually got into school, because I watched him audition the year before and I knew somebody was leaving. So I was like, all right, well, if he's leaving, I'm going to get that little nigga. As soon as he get in there, he just don't really know how his thing is going down. So then, you know, Juan was added when we had, you know, me, Juan, and it was a girl and two other guys. And then Sean actually, again, like Sean said, he kind of had his own little nerdy clique. We didn't really know how well he could sing. We knew he could sing because he's in the choir because, you know, the school don't pick nobody. But he had a solo one year, and I was like, I need him. Mm-hmm. So the next year, somebody else left, put him in. And then it was me, him, Juan, and Mark, and it was just us. Mike just snuck in by mistake. It wasn't like we really handpicked the guy. We were singing in the bathroom rehearsing. Mike walked past us while we were rehearsing. He went to the bathroom taking piss. And while we were singing, he sang along with what we were singing. And you know Mike's voice, you know. So it filled up the bathroom.
In those acoustics, right. Right.
Yeah, so it was like, all right, well, you know, let's see how he works in here. And then that was what you know. And that all came together around 88, right, Sean?
Yes.
88, yeah.
So, okay, for those that don't know, I don't know. I know the legend of the Civic Center story, but how exactly did you finagle your way backstage to Biv? Was it a New Edition performance? Like, what was the actual story that happened?
It was the Powerhouse, Amir.
Oh, shit.
Okay.
It was the Powerhouse. It was the Powerhouse that year, and that was the year that Belle Biv DeVoe was actually being announced. Like Mike and Rick and Ron went to Philly to make an announcement that they were going to be a singing group together. But the thing was obviously Charlie knew Nate. And Charlie was like, yo, I'm gonna have Will let y'all, you know, hear y'all sing. You know what I'm saying? And he was like, all right, cool. So we sitting out, you know, front, waiting for Charlie to show up or whatever. He never showed, but we knew we ran into Teddy Pendergrass's daughter.
Yeah.
Nana. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Nana Pendergrass, right? So she was and she was like, yo, I'm gonna get y'all in. So we got in. That's another story. So we got into the venue, right? Right? So we got into the venue. And so we're waiting around the backstage area, right? So I don't know, and Nate, you can help me out. Who was the first person
to kind of
Mark, Mark started talking to her, whatever, and she was there obviously because of her dad. So she had a friend with her, and they had one extra pass. I guess it was somebody else who was waiting for. So Mark kind of finagled the pass from him, and he went backstage, and they were kicking it, whatever. And then he borrowed one of theirs and came back out, gave it to one of the guys. Then we kept switching the pass back and forth till everybody got back there. And by the time we got back there, Rick and Ron and them was coming off stage because they was actually hosting the show. So they was coming off stage from introducing the group. And when they came off stage, we was like, we asked Ricky first, like, yo, dude, we got, can we sing for you? And he was like, y'all got a tape, tape back then. Y'all got a tape. Mm-hmm. And we was like, nah, we ain't got no tape. We could just sing it right now. And he's like, well, y'all got to send us a tape. And then Ron was like, yeah, well, y'all could send it. He writing the address. And I was like, man, fuck that. So I asked Mike, I was like, yo, dude, can we sing for you? Mike was like, can you do it right now? We was like, yeah. He's like, all right, cool. And we just rocked in the what was it? I can't remember.
Rain. Can't Stand the Rain.
Yeah, Can't Stand the Rain. Acapella. And everybody was standing around watching. And by the time we finished, Charlie showed up.
And it was, I'm talking about Keith Sweat. Look, Keith Sweat was there. When we finished, surrounding us was Keith Sweat, Paula Abdul, Sherelle.
Yeah.
All of, like, Will Smith.
All the hot art, yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah. Will came in after we finished singing.
Will
soon
came
as we were finished singing, Will came in with a red leather jumpsuit.
Yep.
And his herringbone that said Fresh Prince. Mm-hmm. with Charlie. And then
what's funny is after we finished, Rick was like, well, y'all still gotta send us a tape. And Mike was like, nah, y'all niggas ain't gotta send me nothing. Here, I'm gonna be here at this time. Call me in about a week and a half, and that was it.
Wow. It just to hear that story, it's almost like creative Russian roulette, because if Charlie Mack showed up in time, it would have been a whole different trajectory.
Absolutely.
Like, anybody standing backstage could have been a different result.
That's real talk.
That is like crazy.
Everybody learned that's something. Charlie.
Charlie Mack learned that's at that Charlie. Moment not to be late. We learned not to depend on Charlie Mack.
I had this same conversation with Charlie, and he denies this whole story.
Of course he did. What? Of course he did.
Nope. Like, that's not right.
For real?
He denies that this is... No. See, you're not Charlie.
Yeah. And first of all, Sean, what's funny is that... Amir, check this out. Not only did we have to get backstage, we didn't even have tickets to get in. I can't even remember how we snuck in the building in itself.
Yeah, right.
It's quite a few people's story for Powerhouse, though. Powerhouse has its own legacy in that way.
Yeah.
But you know what? Honestly, we started to realize that everybody was sneaking in the Powerhouse after that. After we told the story, everybody was sneaking Powerhouse.
Oh, dude, I hate y'all for this story simply because then suddenly comes the onslaught of, yo, can I spit for you real quick? Yo, can I spit? Because they hear the story, and then they're like, can I spit for you real quick? Can I spit for you real quick? And it just happened.
What's funny is they do it for us, too. And now we be like,
okay. Oh, give me a chance. Like, I give me a chance.
Yeah.
Is there someone established right now that has a story for y'all? Like, I came to y'all first, and y'all didn't hear
it? Yes, a lot of people.
Yes.
People established now. Who?
Y'all. Music came to us when we were at the Vibin video shoot. We were shooting Vibin.
We got to South Philly too, and I didn't even know he could sing.
Yep, he's one. It's a couple of them, bro.
I remember
poor music.
Rodney Jones.
Wow.
Akon. Gave us a CD or something. We was on the bus somewhere.
A whole lot of records, bro.
Yeah, yeah.
Y'all could have had Akon.
We could have had. He was writing music for us. It would like crazy.
Oh, that would have been crazy.
Yeah.
I could see how the voice was.
Man.
Wow.
Yeah, man, It happens.
So, all right. When the whatever day
get
that
it out,
stands.
Nigga.
Whatever day that stands in your mind for officially arriving.
Right.
What lesson would you tell yourself back then that you wish you knew as a precautionary tale? I'm only asking this because I tell people, I told someone, like, I think last episode I said I spent my entire event in 3 weeks, not knowing that that was it.
Cursing records.
Right. I blew my whole advance on like four stopping sprees, and that was it. What lesson did you wish you knew then, the first time you got put on, like that first year? Am I DJ Vlad now?
No. I thought I knew.
You're in the culture.
You are not that.
Thank you. I thought I had my business in order. I thought when my group signed a 50-50 publishing deal with Mike Bivens that it was a 50-50 publishing deal. And without me going too deep into it, it wasn't.
Okay. So you wish you would have fought for that?
I wish I would have known a little bit more at that moment than I knew 4 months after that, because it didn't take much long to figure it out. But it was a life-changing decision that if it was made early for all of us that point, 4 months, 5-6 years later, things would have been a lot different.
A lot different,
Okay. To ask, was the parting with Biv amicable?
It was not at first. I mean, I think we're better now.
To this day, are you fine now?
I think we're better now, but at that time, it was not amicable at all. No.
It was actually, the funny thing is he was literally forced to part with us.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Because it was between Boys to Men and Biv 10 Records. You know what I mean? And we were both involved with Motown Records at the time. So,
right.
You know, he had to make a choice because they said it was a conflict of interest and he chose Biv 10 Records.
Yeah, he had
but
a big
it did not take away from the fact that he had 50% of our publishing.
and writers.
Was Gerald Busby a part of that? What role did he play?
He was an integral part of it. At the time that we split, it was during the time that Motown was going through a major transition of being sold to a larger record label. And we were a key piece.
And we basically let
him know. We were, at that time, we were about 9 million records in, or 8, something like that. Whatever, it was a lot. And, you know, we saw all of the, you know, bad deals surrounding us. And we were like, yo, in order for us to kind of continue and make records, you know, we basically very kindly said, well, you got to fix this deal or else we're not making any more records. So in, you know, trying to fix the whole situation, Gerald presented Biv with the Biv 10 deal, Biv 10 record. Gotcha. Because we were signed
up. Actually, that deal that deal was predicated on Mike finding 3 artists, which he did. Before we even met Mike, it was set up for him to find artists, and then if his artists were successful, he would roll over into that record label, which the artist was us, another Bad Creation, and at that time, MC Brings. He had 3 successful artists. But because we were on the back end of that, like Sean said, our numbers weren't right for us. Gerald pretty much said, listen, I got this deal with you, but you can't be in these guys' pockets too. You got to figure something out, because these guys are holding up my company now. So if they don't make a record, I got a problem with you. So he jammed him up saying, listen, you can take one or the other. You can take this Biv 10 deal and roll and rock with that, or you can rock with them. And he knew we weren't really happy because early on, you know, we figured this thing, like I said, it wasn't too far. We figured this thing out about 2.5 million records. I'm like, this money ain't right. So we rolled it out 14 million records, knowing that it was wrong. So by the time we got there, he chose to go with Biv 10 because he produced his 3 records that artists that was supposed to, you know, was successful. And then we ventured off. So Gerald made that split happen. Or otherwise, Mike would still be a part of Boyz II Men in some kind of way right now.
Wow.
Damn. Sure. So I guess the boy Fruit Punch didn't deliver too much.
No. And he didn't get out much.
All right. So what's the process of deciding what the creative vision is, at least for your records? Like, okay, you got a record deal. And I know that, you know, the characters in Dallas collaborated with you guys, but who decides, like, who says that, okay, let's start off with, I've never, besides the SOS band, I don't know many groups that have thrived starting their album off with three ballads. That's just something I never
listen.
I heard about. I was like, wait a minute. They're starting with the ballads.
Please don't go, boy. Woo.
Right.
Woo.
Exactly.
Well, so well, you know what? It wasn't supposed to happen. Who's navigating? That way. We didn't have any records. Yeah. They didn't know what to do with us. They signed an R&B group that could sing, and they loved it. But once we made the, once we got signed, they didn't have any songs. So, like, you know, all the songs that was on the first album, if you look at, we wrote all those in Performing Arts. We wrote those in those hallways, in those rooms.
Before we even had a deal.
Yeah, before we had a deal. We had those songs done, and they were like, Dallas, we're going to put you with this group. What songs you got? Dallas had Motown Philly sitting around from the Joyce Irby days. But other than that, Dallas Austin had no more records. So we was like, oh, well, we got... You know, we do it so hard to say goodbye to yesterday as a cover. You know, we wrote Please Don't Go and Lonely Heart. And this is my, we like, we wrote this all those records in high school. So we just start recording them.
And Dallas put the production, he produced the record. We sung it to him and he sat there and figured it all out and produced the record. And, you know, those songs that you actually hear were already pre-written.
And as far as the ballads is concerned, you got to, people tend to forget that Motown Philly was the first single. It wasn't a ballad.
Right. Okay. No, I just meant in terms of
the record itself.
Who's the alpha that decides, okay, this is the title of the album. This is going to be like...
That was Biz. I think that was Biz. And I think, you know, him talking to us, he kind of understood our strengths in the albums specifically. This specific album, Coolie High Harmony, and the ballads had such a presence that we all agreed that, you know, the adagio side was the best side, you know.
That was the Performing Arts we stole.
Right. So we wanted that just as much because those hit different with us, you know what I'm saying? And it hit different with our friends. We would bring friends over and stuff like that. I mean, they loved the ups, but the ballads just kind of, that kind of made it real fast.
Yeah. Y'all went through that list kind of fast. I'm just curious, those songs that you said that you wrote in high school were what? And then how did that division, I'm so curious, the songwriting process and the division of work.
Well, Nate wrote Please Don't Go and Lonely Heart in school. Right? As we were going along with the process of doing the record, you know, we started coming up with ideas. Wanya and Nate wrote
Well, no, me and you, we wrote This Is My Heart in school.
This Is My Heart.
I wrote my part on the train, on the L.
That's right. And then I came
And Juan wrote his, you know, the loving and crazy and only time.
Mm-hmm.
And like, he, you know what I mean? Like, and he wrote that in the studio.
Me and Sean wrote Motown Philly in my backyard.
We wrote that in Mr. Walker's room, bro. I promise you.
Which one?
Loving and kissing and holding your tongue.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
Okay. No.
Yeah.
You're right.
Mr. Walker.
Yo, so just to reiterate what y'all said earlier for the novices, for people who just listening, y'all wrote these songs in high school, and yet and still you only got 50% of these songs.
And that's when
you look at, like, me and Sean sitting in my backyard, right, Motown Philly, you know, when... I mean, again, I give Biv all the credit for, you know, a lot of the creative stuff, you know, the idea of creating a song called Motown Philly, the idea of coming up with a song called Ooh-Ah. Titles and concepts are great, but none of that ever entitled you to having 50% of my song. And that's where things started to go left. And we, you know, we looked up to him a lot. So our thing was, you know, that's our guy, you know what I'm saying? It's cool. We understand. But once we start to realize money is coming through and we still in South Philly, something's got to change. But I don't want to get back on the negative. I'm going to stay on the other stuff. As far as the songs, like I said, me and Sean did Motown Philly in my backyard. And then Juan, we were all sitting in my brother's room. And like I said, Biv came up with the idea, you guys need to write a song called Ooh-Ah. And niggas was like, Ooh-Ah, what the fuck? So we was like... Nobody wanted to write it. So we sit there, we all flipped the coin, and Juan lost. So he had to write it. So he started writing the song.
We all went back in the studio.
I wrote it on the toilet, son.
Both versions?
I was about to ask, yeah, which one?
Both versions?
The remix was the fire. Remix. Yeah, I was going to say, I'm the remix person.
Yeah, the remix was
I think me and Sean did the remix, I think.
Yeah, we did. I did the track.
Yeah, anyway, Juan started writing it. He came to the studio, and he couldn't finish it. So he's like, yo, dude, you know,
I finished it, but you said it ain't nasty.
I said it ain't nasty enough. And he was like, well, dude, I mean, you know, what are we supposed to do? I said, give it here. So I rewrote some of it.
Yep.
I rewrote it and wrote more parts of it. And then we started singing it. Juan was like, I don't know, man, my dad ain't gonna be proud of me with this song. We just like, all right, well, go ahead. We just pushed record and just kept going. It was like, we ain't around trying to impress your dad right now. So Juan came in the studio late the day we were recording, and we had a girl in the studio. Didn't make the record, but we had a girl in the studio making these sounds and stuff on the.
Oh yes,
she's the mic, right, Mike?
Yeah, but I mean, like some of the stuff that we had didn't make the record.
Oh,
but
oh.
Anyway.
Because
so
the video was enough,
in,
the video.
Juan came in, I was on the console, Juan came in, and he heard the girl, and he looked in the booth, was like, what is this? He's like, oh, we're just trying to, you know, get the song where it needs to be. He's like, dude, I told you, my dad ain't going to be proud of it. And he ran out and slammed the door, me and Sean looked at each other like, all right, try it again one more time, or you go from the top. Just kept going with the song. So again, almost all those songs except two on the first album, we all wrote either in high school or on the way to the studio or in houses getting ready to make that record because Motown had no songs for us.
They didn't know what to do with us at all.
Wow. So how difficult was the transition in your personal lives? Again, I can only speak from experience that your life drastically changes, and probably the people that change the most on you are your are family members, like people that are close to you and whatnot. How awkward or not awkward, what's that adjustment like with your first year into coming out with as far as like interacting with friends from your childhood and people that feel entitled?
Yeah,
or...
I can't say that there's been like some melodramatic like change personally from people that I knew. The people that I knew were actually in support of me even before all of this stuff.
Okay.
So when it happened for me personally, they were like, okay, that makes sense. Because I was the kid that was in the Philadelphia Boys Choir at 8, you know, okay. And I did these things and that, you know, all that other stuff. So when it came down to, oh, I'm in the group. Yeah, you had a couple little knuckleheads. It's like, oh, nigga, I don't believe you. Until, you know, it all happened. But it was never like, oh, nigga, you know, give me some money or some credit. It wasn't a movie scene. It was all supportive in the sense where when I came back to my neighborhood, everybody was like, yo, what's up? And I would sit in my old stoop just with my, you know, the same friends that I had, and we'd hang out and kick it. I think it's the same with everybody. I mean, no one.
Not me, cuz.
Not me.
Not me, cuz.
Nah.
I had everybody like, Nate. Yo, dude, like, yo, you supposed to come. You supposed to get us up all out of here. And I'm sitting here going through it because I'm a logical thinking guy. So I go through my head. I'm like, and I asked this dude, all right, it's five of y'all out here. Let's just play this game for a second with you. I'm supposed to make it and come back and get all of y'all out. So if I come get all five of y'all out and give y'all all my stuff, y'all gonna be gone and I'm gonna be back here on this corner by myself. I'm not gonna be here by myself. I'm not giving y'all nothing.
Yeah.
And that's how that went.
Well, with me it was a little different because now I'm from the project. I'm from Richard Island Project.
Richard Island.
And, yeah, and
now Northern Liberties.
Exactly.
Now $500,000 homes.
Exactly. So I'm from Richard Island, and a lot of people that when I became famous, they were my age. You know what I'm saying? There was a lot of cats that was my age, but they were doing other things. You know what I'm saying? They were street pharmacists. You know what I'm saying? They were, you know, they was hustling. They was doing all the different stuff, but they always supported me. You know what I'm saying? Once we became, you know, famous, so to speak, we actually you know, when I would come back, every time I would come back, somebody was in jail or dead. You know what I'm saying? And it was their brothers and sisters who were now older and in the place where they were. So they didn't have the same respect for me as their brothers.
The OGs did.
Brothers, you know what I'm saying? Who was like, yeah, we finally made it. You know what I'm saying? That's how they felt. But then as they started going, you know, to prison and, you know, passing away and stuff, there was no respect there. I even had to move my grandmama out of, and she loved the projects. She loved it. Even when I was making money, she really literally wanted to stay there. You know what I'm saying? Because that's really all she knew for so long. But I had to move her out of there because I couldn't go and sit out in front of her house with my Benz now, you know what I'm saying? With my Benz and or in my truck, and people just walk by. It was always something. And my grandma was here and getting a lot from it. And she basically was like, yeah, they talking crazy. I said, well, you gotta move out of here. And I just bought her a
condo. The heat was coming for sure.
Yeah. So I mean it's different. I mean, family is a little different too, of course, because like you said, there's always an entitlement somewhere. It's not necessarily always the immediate, but there's always an entitlement of a cousin, of a cousin, of a cousin. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I'll tell you what's funny.
That you do know, but they're not really, you know, a part of your life like that, you know.
I'll tell you what's funny with me is that I had to try to because I always try to think a little bit ahead. I had to try to think for family members who don't really understand the change of the lifestyle. And in some cases, you know, obviously when you become successful, you can't bring your whole family, you know, out of the ghetto. I mean, there are people still live there and whatnot, to the point where I had to start seeing my family at my house, because I always felt like me driving up in my car, going in their house, I'm kind of endangering them. Because when I leave, whoever saw that car pull up is like, well, why was he going in there? What's in there that I don't know about? So I would always have to wind up having my family come to me, and I had to kind of pull up from going to see my family, just not to put them in those spots.
Yeah, it's a controlled environment if they come to see you.
Yeah, exactly.
How burdensome is in the end of the road in retrospect? How burdensome is it?
Like, I understand what he's saying.
How do you feel like? No. Even when it was happening, you know, okay, so I was obsessively reading Billboard. Like, this is right before we got put on. So I was always hanging in industry circles. I was interning at Rough House.
Right.
So when it got to that 12th week, like every 40-year-old white guy was like, yo, they're about to break the Beatles record. It was like Santa Claus wasn't real.
He had no idea.
No, for real. There was like, it was like Santa Claus wasn't real, and they're going to break this record in the next. And it happened. Like, did it feel any way, or was it just like, it's number
one?
When we got the news, we were in London. And, you know, we were overseas most of the time that End of the Road was doing what it was doing. So when we finally got the news, we were literally 10 minutes in going to on stage at the Hippodrome in London, England. And someone told us, hey guys, you know, you guys broke the record, you know, longest number one, blah blah blah. And we were like, oh cool.
I think it was
very Philly,
honestly. we didn't really know how much it meant. Like, again, the same way we were in high school was the same exact way we were in the business for a long time. It was just find the song, learn the song, sing the song better than any damn other group can ever sing it on the planet, and keep doing it again and again and again. And every single day, that's all everything was about. So all the other stuff that was going on, that didn't even matter. It's like, okay, well, now we're finished. What time is rehearsal? Rehearsal's at 7. We got to get these harmonies right for the next thing. It was just never a time to even think about that. We just didn't know how big that was.
Right. And the funny thing was, is at the same time, is if we knew that the record even existed, like you said, you were around that circle, Amir. So you know what I mean? People were saying, oh God, this is about to happen. We didn't even know that there was a record that existed that needed to be broken. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So if we were like waiting for like, oh, we're about to do it. Yeah. We did it.
what I'm saying?
We yeah. wouldn't do it.
I guess if you're living it, if you guys are actively working, living it, and I'm observing it, it's different. Like, at that point, I was observing it. Right. So for me, like, me observing those first 2 years was just like, wow. Like, someone that I actually know is doing something. Yeah, doing something fucking big.
Right. And let me tell you another. Let me tell you one real quick. We got the same vibe with y'all, and this was crazy. Mm-hmm. We was running around doing all this stuff, went up to Canada, whatnot. You know, Canada, they got all the gear and whatnot.
Right.
The first time we ever heard Roots was the clothing line in Canada. So we was like, jackets is nigga. We heard y'all as the Roots. We was like, oh, no, we know that's a fuck what? That's dude, no. that's Amir. No, for us, it was like we just felt like yo, our other brother made it. You know what I'm saying? Like that was just so and dope then the for truth us. Happened. Like, because that's the only way that was our only time we ever heard anything about a Roots. And then it was like, oh, it's a group? And they, we know them niggas, yo! And that was it, cuz.
I wish. No.
But they forgot about your ass after high school, huh, Amir? It was like, oh.
No, dude.
Oh, no.
Wait. No, for real. I got to tell you that I had to throw that shirt away.
Which one?
Because, all right, so look, it's weird. I know your lives have changed, but imagine a 2.6 second cameo.
In a video, yeah.
We didn't even talk about that.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, we didn't even talk about that.
A 2.6 second cameo. It literally, changed my life at that point. To the point where, like, Tariq would come by the crib. We go by, and he's like, wait, what are you doing? I was like, I don't know. He's like, you're not wearing the shirt. I said, I'm not wearing that shirt, yo. He's like, go get the shirt, man. The shirt's dirty. I'll wait. Like, that outfit had to have been worn. The worst it ever got was at my grandmom's funeral.
Wow.
I'm not lying to you.
Wow.
It's... Like, you guys were so popular.
So when they asked you to be in the video, Amir, how long did you take to say yes?
Hell yeah.
Oh,
dude,
okay.
Being in a video was like,
yeah.
And that's why, and the funny
that was
thing
like
is.
Being verified on Instagram.
Exactly.
Right.
What's even funnier, man, is that back
like
then,
you wake
dude,
up at 4 in the morning
thing.
All excited, looking at your outfit like, yo, where
yeah, it's like Easter. But it's funny because back then, dude, as soon as we got the word that we was doing Motown Philly and we knew we was doing it in Philly, just nature for us was like, who do we know? Who's our people? Amir, Tashel. But we would anybody we grew up with, like, Tashel we got to get
Johnson.
Everybody in the video. Yeah,
was it Angie in that video?
Tashel Johnson.
Was it Angie in that video too?
Larry Lair.
Angela Nizzle.
Yeah. She wasn't in
that. We tried our best to get
EST.
Everybody in that video.
EST.
Because we wanted Philly to be finally on the map with us. We couldn't go on the map without everybody else.
Hansel was in it, yeah.
Hansel,
it was like all the,
yeah.
All the
Hansel, oh my God.
It might be Reverend Hansel. I don't know what.
Much respect to Hansel.
Yes, he's Reverend Hansel.
He's the Reverend now.
Wow. One of them tax-free boys.
Yeah.
All
right. Yeah.
Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it.
That free Jesus money. All right, I got you.
I'm fucking with Nate.
Tax-free.
Hey man, I know the get up. Come on now.
For real. Like I had to throw the shirt away and not rock that shit no
that's
more.
Crazy. Nah, man, that's what's
it's,
up.
Yeah, but it got crazy. No, what I do want to know is, can you guys speak on Khalil Roundtree, like your relationship with him and the effect that had on you?
Greatest man in our life.
Khalil through Biv because Khalil was road manager for New Edition. And
we met him in Philly, right, guys? We met him in where's that rehearsal place we used to rehearse on?
RPM.
At
RPM, right?
RPM on Delaware Avenue.
Right. So
20 Delaware Avenue, baby.
Yeah. And you know, to make a long story short, you know, Khalil became our father figure. You know, somebody that looked out for us and protected us from everything and everybody. And you know, even though Biv brought him in, and initially his loyalty was to Biv, you know, that slowly turned into something else. Like, you know, he started to love us just like we started to love him. And it became us, you know.
When you talk about that, were your fathers like in you guys' lives? Like, what was the status of that?
Okay. But, you know, they weren't on the road with us.
Gotcha.
You know what I'm saying? Like, when we were on the road and we were traveling and doing all the stuff that we were doing, he took on that father, you know, figure. You know,
yeah. Mine was out, but yeah.
Right. Gotcha. So, but for the most part, he took care of all of us, and he made sure that, you know, we were not only safe, but that we were carrying ourselves the right way, and that, you know, we stayed motivated, and even during rehearsals and all that other stuff. Like, he was something special because, you know, he really gave a shit about us. It wasn't just a paycheck, you know, to Khalil. Like, he became an integral part of all of our families. He would talk to all of our mothers on the road, and, you know, because the mothers would be calling on the road, making sure that we were all right. He would talk to each and every one of them, making sure that they knew that, you know, we were safe and all that. Like, he became something different than just the average road manager. I mean,
yeah, he actually, my dad was only comfortable with me being on the road when he met Khalil. Once he met Khalil, he was like, okay, I'm cool.
Yeah. Now. Right. I was like, he was like a partner for me, man. Like I said, my dad wasn't around. So, you know, I think I got the call first from Biv about a guy that he was looking into, and Khalil had, it was the night before we all met him. He was staying at an airport Marriott or whatever, and, you know, he had one of the big giant silver case with all his cassettes lined up on his thing in his room. I remember that. And when I first walked in, dude, I mean, I was a little intimidated because, you know, Khalil's a big dude. I mean, he's a big guy. So
yes, he is.
And that real deep voice, you know what I'm saying? So it was almost like the father figure that kind of, you know, put you in line without you mentally knowing it. But, you know, once you got to know him, you knew he was a big teddy bear overall, but he was just always, he was never going to tell you something that either wasn't right or something that was bullshit. That just was not the guy. You know, if someone tried to, you know, say, hey, well, you know, I need you to do this, or, you know, in the business, whatever, like, yeah, we need you to get your artist to do. He was never that guy. Like, I'm not getting my artist to do anything. Like, I'm going to tell them what it is, and then we're going to talk about it. He was that guy. So he taught us early on the ins and outs of that whole business thing. So, like Sean said, you know, he was more than a father. He was everything we could have possibly asked for.
Yeah.
What year was it when he passed? I remember seeing y'all. This was, I mean, God, I was in like seventh grade. Y'all came to Greensboro Coliseum, and I want to say it was the Budweiser Superfest, but I remember it was y'all, Jodeci, and Hammer was the headliner.
The Hammer 2 was the Quit Tour thing.
Yeah, I think it was 92, 93.
Yeah, it was like 92, 92. Yeah. That was around the year when he passed?
Yeah, it was 92. Yep. We were on the Hammer Tour.
Yeah, it was in Chicago. We just finished playing the Rosemont Horizon. No, and what was funny is we all kind of like kind of key in on this particular moment, the night that he passed away or got murdered. Khalil was a very confident dude. Mm-hmm. Every move that he made, everything that, you know, he wanted us to do, he said it with
calculated.
You know what I'm saying? We're going to do this. We're going to do that. We're going to do this. This was the first night.
I don't know.
That we ever... seeing Khalil say, "Where y'all? What hotel y'all want to stay in?" Mm-hmm. I don't know which hotel I want to stay in.
Well, yeah, he had came to us with the promoter's idea. I guess the promoter wanted us to stay in. You know, our promoters, they got a cheaper hotel over here.
The cheap ones, right?
Mm-hmm. Where, you know, all the crew is staying. So I want to move the guys. And like Sean said, Khalil was never indecisive. He was always, "Well, this is where they going? You're doing this. This is where they going? Because I said so." And he came to us in the dressing room. It was like, you know, the promoter, you know, would save him some money if you guys did this, so forth and so on. you know, I don't really know what, I mean, I'm kind of on the fence. What do y'all want to do? And we were like, I mean, Kay, it's up to you, whatever. You know what I'm saying? We don't really, whatever you want to do. And he picked the hotel. And unfortunately, that was the hotel where guys came in and, you know, I don't like to talk about it. So I appreciate you
sharing that. I'm sorry.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? Well, no, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I do have to ask, though, because I know that singing is, I at least see singing as an intimate thing. And I know that you guys are like brothers. You know, when Tariq and I are angry with each other, like, the Root Show can still happen.
Absolutely. And,
you know, because I mean, we're not facing each other. But how do you guys handle if there's friction between y'all and you still have to do the intimate act of singing with each other and harmonizing?
We do it, because actually the funny thing is that music, it actually supersedes everything. You know what I mean? What we do together is magic. And it's like, you know, literally, you know, sometimes I literally listen to how we create and figure out certain parts without even thinking about it. You know what I'm saying? So when we're on stage, we all know that we have a job to do, for one. But at the same time, we also know that this person next to me is going to do that job better than anybody that I could ever, you know what I'm saying? So the respect level is really like, I know what he's here to do. I know what Sean's here to do. I could be pissed off at him, he could be mad at me, but we know what we got to do because our integrity is involved. You know what I'm saying?
It helps heal the craziness.
Is singing your version of Don't Go to Bed Mad? So
Almost.
Yeah.
Again,
because after we finish
performing, if we are having issues, most of the time after we finish performing, somebody will come to somebody's room. Somebody will say something to some. It will always. It takes away everything because of what we just did on stage. That right there, together, is greater than the anger that we have, you know, for each other.
Was it always like that?
Yeah. I mean, we have fist fights and then go back and go out on stage and rock.
Literally.
I mean, it's just, I mean, again, we grew up as brothers, literally. Like, I have three brothers. I have my brother, and then I have my brothers. I mean, we don't know anything else. I mean, I always say that, you know, when we started earlier talking about how much time we've been together, we've been together longer than any of us have been together with any family member, that even our mothers. Like, we spent more time with each other than our own parents. Yeah. Like, there's not one family member in any of our families that we have spent more time around than each other.
That's so, I mean, that right there, like, I mean, it's really that it answers itself. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. that's what family do. You know, of course, you know, you go through things, you fight, you argue, but at the end of the day, you know, we still family. That's, and we do something together better than anybody, I believe.
And we're the only one that can say what we say about each other, and you can't call my brother that. I can say it. Right. You can't say it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Facts. It's that.
Facts. Right. Yeah. Because we were getting into the two album, we're End of the Road. Before we got there, I wanted to go back a little bit. So one of my boys in Hot Takes, I have several, as a longtime fan, my favorite album for y'all, like, I'm Coolie Out Harmony. I love Coolie Out Harmony. Outside mm-hmm. of Coolie Out Harmony, I always thought that some of the best just writing, songwriting, vocal, everything was on Christmas Interpretations. I fucking love that album, man. Like, y'all niggas was in y'all bag on that shit, man.
we had to fight for that.
Really? That. What was the story?
Well, the label wanted, you know, a typical Jackson 5, you know, ho 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 Santa Claus Christmas record, and we weren't mm-hmm. gonna do that. Like, we didn't want to fall into that platform of ho 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 and jingle bells. So we fought to try to do an original Christmas record. And we didn't have any songs, again. So we all sat around and said, all right, well, here, Sean, you do two. Juan, you do two. I'm going to do two. Mike, you do two. And then we said, okay, well, since we did, you know, since we rock out with McKnight, because that's our boy, you know, mm-hmm. we'll have him come in and we'll have him produce it with us. And if he's got a song or two, we'll throw it on and we'll rock out like that. Everybody just wrote two songs and we just went for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nah, I love that, because it was, you know, like hearing you say you didn't want to do just a typical, you know, jingle bells, you know, kind of record. Right. Yeah. But all the songs, I mean, they were just great songs that could have been, they could have worked year round. Like, they weren't relegated. Like, I would listen to that album in March. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that shit was
yeah.
jamming.
Yeah, you know what? That's a comp. I appreciate that, Fonzie. But, you know, going back to a question that you said, like, a little while ago, as far as, like, things that I regret. No, I don't think I regret it. Just more or less, I wish that there was more emphasis applied on me and my guys' ability to write music. Because we tried our best to, even Nate and I, you know, we tried to be the next LA and Face or Jam and Lewis or something like that.
All right.
We felt like that was like a natural progression for us to kind of go into that realm. And, you know, I'm speaking of all of us. Wanya got a crazy pen. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we've all written records for us and for other
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
That, you know, I wish for my guys that we were, I guess that was more emphasized on. But because mm-hmm. Boyz II Men was such a phenomenon and it was such a juggernaut in itself, it seemed like all of our folks, honestly, looking at it in retrospect, a lot of people, even down to Gerald, who's just like Wanye said, they didn't know what to do with us. So when we were successful, they were like, what the fuck is this?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? Like, everybody was kind of like, well, how long is this candle going to burn? So everybody's mentality wasn't, hey, let's move these gentlemen forward to the next stage. As I look back at all the events that's happened to us and the people that came in and out of our lives, it almost felt like let's get this money now because we don't know how long this train is going to last.
Gonna last.
Mm. Yeah. So a lot of our folks had that mentality. They didn't look beyond the fact that yo, Nate was a great songwriter. Yo, Juan could have been a solo artist. You know, Sean could have did. Mike could have had. You know what I'm saying? Like they didn't go that far with us.
Yeah.
They just said, okay, there a moment. Let's snatch and grab, and then let's move on to the next thing. And the case in point of that is when during the Evolution album, when we came out with the Evolution album, mm-hmm. this was around the time the boy band thing started to come up. Mm-hmm. So you felt, from our standpoint, you actually felt the shift of people's priorities going from us to them. Like literally, mm-hmm. like yeah. our literal budget in Motown was literally taken from us and given to 98 Degrees.
Wow. Wow.
Like
yeah, it's real.
Like they like these things happen. And it was almost like they were done. Like everybody was done with us.
It's almost mind-boggling that they couldn't just add singer songwriter to any time y'all names were sent. Because well, I'm really thinking well, about that what? In the
did they have
I'm,
you work with these acts?
I'm gonna tell you what happened. When okay. we did the first record, like we said, we had records that were ours. They didn't know what to do with it. So it was almost like, well, we don't know if this record's going to do well. Let's let the guys do whatever they're going to do, and we'll see if the project does well. Project sold 12 million records. So at that point, the label was like, okay, so we need to make it bigger. Who else can we get on this record? Now, here's the caveat that people tend to forget. The original Coolie High Army album did not have End of the Road on it. It wasn't part of the original album.
Yep.
That song was done for the soundtrack for the Eddie Murphy Boomerang.
Yep.
After Coolie Out Harmony was already out. So what, if you notice, the original Coolie Out Harmony album had us with the trench coat, the Sherlin coats on, the canes right. And the little squares mm-hmm. around it. I think that original album probably might've got to about 4.5-5 million records.
Yes, that's true.
When they did the Boomerang deal, they did the deal to where, okay, well, they can use it on the soundtrack. We'll have the guys perform the song. They'll perform it. We'll put it on that set record. And then we'll also have to put it on, we'll have the rights Motown took to put it somewhere else. So they repackaged the Coolie Out Harmony album because they saw that we were starting to have a pop. We had a pop audience. So they said, okay, well, let's get the bright color, the bow ties, throw this song on there, re-release this as a single off that album. And then that album goes to 12 million. So now their mind is like, okay, well, now we need those kind of songs and those kind of songwriters, not Coolie Out Harmony songs, but those kind. So then they went to Jimmy and Terry, they went to Babyface. And as we were trying to grow as artists, like artists always say, hey, well, we wrote some of those songs on the one that did 5, 6, can we write? Oh yeah, well you could write some stuff, but right now we need these guys. So, you know, us taking the approach of just let's focus on making sure we sing the right notes and do what we got to do, we didn't hammer home right away with trying to be on top of it. We got pushed away to the point where it was like, okay, well, bring Dallas Austin back because he's a producer. Artists and producers back then, the producer was always more important than the artist because the producer could produce 15 or 30 records on 15, 20 artists that the label had. The artist is just one entity. So it was always more important for labels to make allegiances with producers and songwriters. Keeping us from becoming super producers and songwriters took the power away from us to just be singers. Yeah. So they wrapped Ellie in face and everybody around it and not knocking it that it didn't do well, but it did stifle what Sean was talking about, our ability to grow as songwriters. And they kind of threw us a bone like, well, here, go hang out with, you know, Dallas's B producers, Tim and Bob, and Tim see and Bob, what you come up with. So we started writing some songs with them, which we happened to get on the 2 album. And one of them, we had to tell them that Dallas wrote in order to get it on the record because they wouldn't put it on there.
Was it vibing?
Yeah, exactly.
No, it wasn't vibing.
We had to lie to the record label and tell them that Dallas Austin wrote that song and produced it because they weren't going to put it on the album.
Wow.
So
was he, and my favorite songs on that album were the ones that y'all did, like Vibin', 50 but, Candles. But, like, no,
but to the record label's point is they were trying to. And then, again, I understand it now because when you really look at it, we can all talk about those records. But if you went to Istanbul, they're talking about End of the Road. They're talking about I'll make love to you. They're not talking about please don't go. They're not talking, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So I understand what they were trying to do, but if it was explained to us a little bit more back then as we were going through, we would understand it other than us feeling like artists, like, well, we're going to get the big names and y'all just go take the ride.
No, but you know what, Nate? Here's the irony of all of it. The irony of all of that, Nate, is the fact that, yes, those guys wrote those songs and things of that nature, and this is no disrespect because there are records, so I can't disrespect my own songs. Mm-hmm. But the biggest one was written by us.
Right.
Once we did. So, you know, despite what they thought, despite what they might have thought we were or what we needed, what we needed was always here. It was always with us, but they never wanted to see that. So they tried to literally manipulate the situation to even make us think that, yo, y'all need them. And it wasn't like, it wasn't a disrespect. It's not a disrespect because Uncle Terry, Jimmy Jet, we love them. You understand? Mm-hmm. With all of our 100%. Hearts. You know what I'm saying? We love Babyface with all of our hearts. So we understand that this was all a business move, but at the same time, one benefited a little bit more than the other from that standpoint. And me being 48 years old, I'm understanding now that life is all about relationships. Life is about growth. Life is all about being able to develop and go from this point to that point. And we all need the help to do it. There's not anybody alive that has not become successful without some sort of leg up by somebody that was in a better position than them. So when I look back at this, this was by design. They wanted us to be here, stay here, and then
they wanted us to sing. That's all they wanted. Singing was easy for them. They didn't want us to dabble in too much. And then it's been said a couple of times throughout our career. And what made it even tougher was that even when we tried to write and produce on somebody else, the name of the group was so overshadowing that all people wanted was, I just want to hear y'all sing and y'all do something. I don't really want Nate's record or vice versa. And not that I don't like it, but I like this better. And that's, you know, it's a double-edged sword. The success is great. But at that point in our career, we had to either live with one or the other. We weren't going to be able to get both.
When it comes to the technical aspect of the creating of a song, is it clear who's going to sing what part? Because to me, like, the three of you have very similar voices and voice ranges. I know there are different, you know, strong suits for each of you. But like when you're writing a song and you're creating it, is it clear who's going to sing what part? It's like Nate, you're gonna sing the melody. Sean, you're gonna sing the tenor part.
Writing for my group is probably the easiest thing in the world because you can literally
you know
exactly who does what. That like you don't even gotta like question or have a tribunal about who's gonna sing this verse or that verse or whatever. You know who's going to sing it, who's gonna send it home, and then the harmonies is just something that most people don't know how we do it, so we just do that.
How long does it take you guys to craft that?
Because here's the deal is that
everybody has their own style with this.
The reason why I think that a lot of it seems more difficult than it is. A lot of producers, i.e. Jimmy Jam, Terry Face, them like working with us because, and this is not, you know, not trying to blow smoke in any way, but honestly, there's not many songs that we can not sing because vocally we cover the gamut from here to here, whether it's one guy, two guys or whatever, we cover the whole spectrum. We're going to sing every single, you can't out key us. That's in the wrong key. You can't do that with us because vocally we just, it's all over the place. So with that being said, like Sean said, it's easy to write for us because throw it against the wall. And to answer your second question, because we grew up in a choral environment, we automatically know where the parts fall. Mm-hmm. But even after that, what made Boys to Men different from just people singing choral is we moved out of that realm a little bit. So if Juan's background part is the first, if Sean's background part is the second tenor, he'll start singing it, and eventually somewhere he'll end up on an alto, second alto part. And most people will say, well, he went out of his range. He's got to stay there. he doesn't have to, because when he's singing that, Juan's already singing where he left the spots open.
Right.
I'm already hearing the spots that they both left open. So it's just a mental
thing.
And
you intuitively know to jump to that place?
It's like, I'm going to make it this simple. You ever have Connect Four? You know how when you drop the thing down and they go click, 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 click? That's pretty much what it is. Wherever that lands, you know when you drop the next one where it's got to go. You just know where it's got to go.
And I'll be totally honest, and that's what I was talking about earlier. It's the magic, you know. The crazy thing is okay, let's just say Sean's in the vocal booth and I'm out in the lobby and Sean sings his note. Blah, 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 blah. He sings his note. When I come in and hear the note that Sean's doing, I automatically know where I'm supposed to go. And it's not even a song that I ever heard before. You know what I'm saying? So then I'll go in and I'll do my part. And then I'll leave. Then Nate will come in, and by the time we finish, it has turned into this
click. And it doesn't have to be in sequential order. Juan could start.
Yep.
Then I'll come in second. Then Sean will come in. Or I'll start, or vice versa. It's just a natural and you know, ability to just feel what each guy's idea for that song is going to be. I mean, it hasn't even gotten more difficult with three people, because I was doing both parts anyway. So it's just rapid. It's quicker, actually, in all.
So was the intention always to sound like a choral group, or was the intention to sound like, I mean, look, I'm a white kid from Long Island. I listen to Boyz II Men religiously forever.
Oh, and you ain't from Africa this time?
No, fuck you. But like, but what I'm fascinated by is, like, I always felt like you guys were four guys at that time, but you sounded like about 20. And like, right. I don't know. I don't think that there was like ultimate stacking. It was just like the notes that you picked and the way that you did it. And I think what I'm getting at, Nate, is like what you said is like, is when you would get to someplace, you would hand it off to Juan and da da da.
Silent Night is the perfect example, and I'm glad Amir mentioned.
Yeah, because that's not normal.
Because what it is that we sang some of it, something like that in high school,
right?
But what we did was we added R&B to it when we took it for our own. And if you notice, there are some chords where literally, I mean, you may have a second, a third, a seventh. It sounds like it's 12 people, but it's not. And especially when you get to that chord at the end, that real big, strong. It sounds like it's 15 people, but it's just the notes that we chose. And with Mike underneath of it, which a lot of people never really had, you could sing three notes and he would only be a fourth away, but it would just make it sound like it's 13 people.
But like, was the intention always like that cluster harmonies would be the thing? I mean, because like gospel for the record is like, it's more the chord. I'm getting real nerdy. The chords are more out in gospel, right? It's like root, fifth,
right.
Root above, and then like third above that, right? That's the stack.
But you guys don't do that. We intentionally didn't.
You don't want nobody follow you in karaoke. Well, I mean,
No, you're right. Like that. We intentionally did that because one, those progressions are boring to us. Like they're boring. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know, like to do 1-3-5. Like, you know what I'm saying? If it's like, okay, we can do that, but there's so many sweet spots in the seventh and then the 13th and like in between and all those other, you know, sustain, you know, chords and harmonies and stuff like that. So those sus chords and all that. So to be able to do that was always the goal. I mean, we grew up on Take Six and the Carpenters and all those guys who did all of that stuff. So that's what we grew up listening to even before we met each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I was going to ask, cause I didn't ask earlier. I know that, you know, Take Six is an influence, but the intricate level of how you guys do your harmonies, it's beyond that. Like, was there influence from Brian Wilson? Like, who are your harmony gods?
I'm gonna tell you, Take Six honestly is the key. But the difference is, when, like I said, when you got six guys and they're moving pretty tight, there's not there's not a whole lot of space for a guy to sing a soprano part and end up all the way down at the baritone because there's six guys in there. But what we did was we tonally, we would listen to them because we knew we didn't have six parts.
Right.
We found the parts that made it sound just like them without all six. Yeah, even if you had to go from the top to the bottom just to make that chord sound like their chord, that's what we would do. We would jump all over the place.
We would move them so that they actually created those sus chords in the middle and then spread out to become something else.
So as a threesome, do you guys have the ability to recreate so much to say?
No.
With just three people?
No, but you know what? That's okay. Because when you're listening to an album, you just want to capture the moment. You want to create the space. You want to create the painting. And and that's all that matters. Like, it's three of us, but if we feel six parts, we're going to sing those six parts. You know what I'm saying? Because that's what's needed
for
that.
But I will say there are things that can sound that strong with three people. And I use our Star Spangled Banner as an example.
Right. Okay.
We used to sing that with four people. But again, now that Mike's not here, we just took that other leg and kind of folded it under and we took the meat of what we needed to make it sonically sound the same way. People just jump in different spots to make it sonically sound the same way. It's just not four people. And the average ear is not going to hear when that one note is not. When you got a triad, and it's a triad of a fifth, a third, and a seventh, you're not worried about what the other note was because it was probably in unison with any other group anyway. You're only focusing on that. Right. So we make sure we give you that, and then we'll peel one off to where it feels like it's open, and then we'll bring them back in. So it's ways to twist it. Like Sean said, obviously records give us a lot more flexibility, but if we have to narrow it down, that's normally how we'll do it.
Yeah. So what happens if a member has laryngitis or...
We'll switch parts. That's happened.
Yeah.
And how long does it take to adjust? Even when Mike had to leave the group, how much work and adjustment did you have to do to figure out how to cover what was missing?
I mean, it's literally us being backstage or somewhere and just arranging it, mentally preparing ourselves because, you know, when you're doing someone else's part, you're doing someone else's character that a lot of people understand that, yo, that's Wanye singing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's no way I'm going to sing like Wanye. So because he puts a stamp on everything that he sings. So there has to be a way to get around it. So you just make a way around it. And, you know, obviously it's not going to sound like Wanye, but we try our best for us not to suck. And if it doesn't suck, then that's good enough. And honestly, we have the type of fans and people that we can be on stage and say, yo, man, Wanye's got laryngitis. He's here. Wow. He's here, guys. Mm-hmm. He's here. He's going to sing his best for you. And people know it. They hear it. They see it. They see him struggling or they see me struggling or whatever.
We'll sing your parts.
And they sing our
for
parts.
Real.
And the audience is going to sing with you, right?
They sing our parts too. So we have that type of out. Like, people have seen us enough to know that we can sing. That's never been a doubt or a question. So somebody has an off day, we just have an off day. And our people understand it. And we just go about the show. And we do it. And our people ride with us.
Ladies and gentlemen, sorry to do it to you, but you know we're going to have to cut it short right now. Trust me, we'll be back next week for more talk with Nate, Sean, and Wanye, Boyz II Men, Questlove Supreme. All right? Come next time. See ya.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS and let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. All right? Peace.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card?
With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves, so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.